underwriters. Please remember to support them and buy Hunterdon, buy local. Visit www.hunterdonchamberradio.com for a complete listing of our programming.
The news is sponsored by the Hunterdon Medical Center. Hunterdon Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterdon Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterdon Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4-HMC or visit us on the web at www.hunterdonhealthcare.org.
USA Radio News with John DeMaster.
The Republican National Committee holds its annual spring meeting in Florida and again says it's not changing the rules for choosing a nominee at the convention.
Stories, the hottest news, and the best radio all in one place. It's available for free on your smartphone, on your computer, and you can listen with your Bluetooth-enabled car. You can listen to classic radio theater. Daybreak USA with Angie Austin and my new show that takes you from online to on air, your news feed on the radio, Trending Today USA with Rusty Humphrey. Check it out, usaradio.com. That's usaradio.com.
The director of the FBI says it costs more to unlock the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters than he'll make in his remaining time on the job. Director James Comey says with just about 7 years left on his 10-year term, he'll make about $1.3 million. The FBI paying a third party to unlock the iPhone of shooter Saeed Farooq. Comey said the price the agency paid was worth it. The D.C. area seeing smoke from a distant fire. We get details from Tom Roberts.
After winds shifted overnight, the effects of a wildfire in Shenandoah National Park were noticed in metropolitan Washington for the first time yesterday. Skies are hazy, and some people have noticed the smell of smoke. The fire has spread quickly this week due to strong winds and dry conditions. I'm Tom Roberts.
Donald Trump says the other Republican presidential candidate should get out of the race. He spoke in Pennsylvania and said he's millions of votes ahead of Ted Cruz and John Kasich and questioned what they're still doing in the race. He suggested that he may become more presidential after he defeats Cruz and Kasich. This is USA Radio News.
I'm Sean Hare, the site director at conservativetribune.com. Conservative Tribune is one of the most visited news sites in the world, and the reason is simple. ConservativeTribune.com delivers edgy and bold commentary of the news every day. We are unapologetically pro-America, unabashedly conservative. At ConservativeTribune.com, we don't make apologies for who we are or what we say. If you're looking for more than boring stories and simple thought, visit ConservativeTribune.com. That's ConservativeTribune.com.
Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan saying Republicans still looking for answers about how money to combat the Zika virus would be spent.
This is something we're going to get done to make sure that we're on top of this problem, that we're moving in the direction toward a vaccine.
The president asking Congress for nearly $2 billion in emergency funding in February. Is the Obama administration threatening states that defund Planned Parenthood? USA Radio's Jason Wirt has more.
The Obama administration has contacted states regarding Planned Parenthood, threatening them if Medicaid patients don't get something they want. Bree Payton of the Federalist tells USA News what the administration told states.
You have a legal responsibility to hand out funds to places that are legally allowed to receive funds, and you have a legal responsibility to make sure that Medicaid recipients are cared for and receive the care that they're entitled to. And if you refuse to comply, then we're going to come after you.
Payton added Democrats in Congress are also looking for ways to actively use the government to assist Planned Parenthood. I'm Jason Wirt.
A state flag display at the U.S. Capitol building being removed because of the Confederate battle flag. Symbols of the Confederate States of America visible on the flags of Alabama, Florida, Georgia, and Arkansas. Michigan Republican Representative Candace Miller said she wanted to get rid of the display because of the association between the Confederate flag, slavery, and racism. And today is Earth Day. It's the anniversary of the birth of the environmental movement, where Earth Day events will be held all over the world. This is USA Radio News, powered by USARadio.com.
Good morning. morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good Morning Hunterdon kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterdon County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterdon, HunterdonChamberRadio.com.
Well, good afternoon. It's Friday. Again, it's Friday, the 22nd of April. Nice day out there. It was supposed to rain so far. It has not been raining. Looks like it still might. But let's look at the weather. What is the weather? Actually, there were some warnings about hazardous weather outlook. Not sure what that meant, because today was about 77 degrees and wind speed only about 5 miles an hour, so it was really very nice. And let's see what they have to say. Even though they said this afternoon they were worried about showers, and now of course I can't read it because it's not, there we go. Actually, this afternoon there was only about a 20%, a slight chance of showers. Tonight there is a chance of showers, 30%, but the high today was expected to be about 78 degrees, low tonight only 57 degrees. And then again in the morning tomorrow, there's a slight chance of showers, only about 20%. And then it should be mostly sunny, high of about 70 degrees. And Sunday should be a beautiful day, sunny, high of about 66 degrees. And then into Monday, even warmer, mid-70s, mostly sunny. And then we're expected to get some rain Monday night, and about a 40% chance on Tuesday. So that's the weather. Looks like it's going to be a nice weekend. And if you want to have a fun time tomorrow, think about coming to Howell Farm. They're doing their potato planting. And if you've never been to Howell Farm, especially if you have kids, it's really delightful for children. The Howell Farm is a historic farm. It's preserved. It's run by the Mercer County. They do a great job. It's just south of Lambertville off of Route 29. But go on their website and you'll see lots of activities. And tomorrow, what everybody will be doing, the volunteers will be planting potatoes. And it's really fun to see the kids plant potatoes, because, of course, and even more fun in the fall to see them harvest potatoes, because they think potatoes come from the grocery store. But it's a great venue for kids. You know, they can run around on the farm. They can see the animals. And better yet, it's free. So tomorrow is the potato planting. And, you know, think about it. If you, you know, have kids, have grandkids, or just want to come out, we participate every year as returned Peace Corps volunteers. There's a group of us that go to the farm. And, in fact, the manager of the farm is a returned Peace Corps volunteer. So it's a great way to get together with some people that had common experiences. So think about it for tomorrow. And I will bring you one spot from one of our sponsors, and then we'll be back to talk about what's been happening in the legal news this week.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program. No drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Well, I'm back, and my name is Pat Smits. For those of you who know me, know that I'm an attorney here in Hunterdon County, and I practice my legal practice is really limited to family law matters, child-related matters, custody, divorce, and all of those things. So what I try to do on this program, if I'm not going to have a guest, and I don't have a guest today, but I'm trying to bring you up to speed on what the important legal news has been in the last week and what cases have been decided that might be of interest to some of our listeners. So I'm always open to suggestions. If you have anyone who would like to be on the program, I'm more than happy to talk to them. Excuse me. Well, the really top stories this week as far as the legal community, and frankly, should be of real importance to the public throughout the state of New Jersey, and that is that the Judiciary Committee approved Walter Timpone as the next Supreme Court justice in New Jersey. Very important. There has been this big standoff between Governor Christie and Democratic legislators going back to when Governor Christie refused to renominate the Supreme Court Justice Wallace, who was really an excellent jurist. There was no reason for him to be to hold up and not renominate him other than politics. And at the time, Governor Christie wanted his own man. So this has been a real problem for the judiciary in New Jersey, because then more recently, Governor Christie threatened not to renominate 23 judges for the trial courts in New Jersey. And we have a real problem with not having enough trial judges as it is, and this would have completely decimated the courts. But as far as they finally worked something out, and Governor Christie, although Mr. Timpone is a Democrat, he is a close friend of Mr. Christie's, and therefore he was acceptable to Governor Christie, and he was acceptable to the Democrats because he was a Democratic appointment to fill a Democratic seat. So, you know, I guess all's well that ends well, except in this case, I have to say, it put incredible pressure on judges who have been sitting and doing great jobs for 7 years because they were going to be up for reappointment. And if they're not renominated, not only don't they have a job, most of them would lose their pension, any pension rights they have, they would lose their medical benefits. And after 7 years of being isolated because they are judges, they'd be out there and have to start practice or go to a firm or find work. And this was really, not only was it stressful for the judges, I think it put a damper on future judges. And I'm sure that anybody in the future who's thinking about wanting to be a judge and thinking about doing the things necessary to become a judge will think twice, because who knows what could happen next. But in any event, the good thing this week is that Governor Christie, he didn't renominate all 23 because they're not really all due for renomination. But in fact, he did renominate four of the judges who would have been out if he had not renominated them. So two of the judges I personally know, Judge Kessler and Judge Rahill, and they're excellent judges. So the fact that he did renominate four sitting judges for tenure is a real benefit for the state. And he also nominated four attorneys to the state superior court. So we're down so many attorneys and, excuse me, so many judges. And there are a number of other judges who are scheduled or have announced that they are going to retire, including our own Judge Bartlett here in Hunterdon County. And let's hope that the process goes much more quickly in getting someone else in her place. Because the last time when a judge retired here, Judge Buxbaum, it took about a year before they filled his spot. So, as I said, great news as far as the new justice, Walter Timpone. And he is a partner at a large law firm in Morristown and has an excellent reputation. So it wasn't just some political hack that was appointed. And unfortunately, the Republican who Governor Christie wanted to nominate was a jurist. He was a judge, and he was an excellent judge. So this is really unfortunate when judges get caught in this crossfire. So there are some other things. Caterpillar, Inc. has asked a Camden federal judge to at least preliminarily approve a $60 million settlement of multi-district litigation over the company's allegedly defective bus engines. So that may be settled. There's also a case involving a malfunctioning of an airplane engine that led to a fatal crash, and a federal appeals court has ruled that the FAA, the Federal Aviation Act, which largely governs in-flight safety, does not preempt state law. Well, this is very interesting. It does not preempt state law products liability claims. So that is an important win for the plaintiffs in that case, that they can proceed on a products liability claim. And also, there's been a settlement of nearly $25 million reached over a New York engineering school's claim that one of its professors and his doctoral student developed the Siri personal assistant technology featured on Apple iPhones and other electronic devices. So this is there's a big win there also. Well, what's happened as far as cases this week? Well, there are certainly other news, but as far as cases approved for publication, as of yesterday, there was a criminal law case. This is from the Supreme Court. Justice LaVecchia wrote the decision, and it said, because the state did not provide adequate proof that the individuals found in a car had been present at the targeted residence when the warrant was being executed moments before their apprehension, the warrant did not provide authority for the search of the two off-premises individuals. So this is a search and seizure case, and the court said, nope, they went too far when they searched two individuals who were not on the premises. And at that, obviously, the warrant was very specific in that case that the officers could, could search, and the warrant was to search a specific residence. So in that case, the guys got off. Possibly, in fact, they were guilty, but they got off because the police overreached the warrant. And frankly, the criminal protections are important, and police officers know and should know what a warrant says is what it means. And very often there are other circumstances, extenuating circumstances that would allow an additional search. So there's been a controversy in New Jersey about arbitration clauses, and there was a recent bid to scale back a 2014 state Supreme Court decision that deemed arbitration pacts voidable if they don't clearly warn the signatories about surrounding litigation rights. And apparently that one has fallen flat. I have yet to read the case, but they didn't agree on that one. And also a federal judge in Camden has dismissed a suit filed by a law firm, a now defunct law firm, and its former leader against the IRS and the U.S. Treasury and the IRS agent over allegedly illegal tax collection practices. So whatever the IRS did to collect the taxes, they won.
in this particular case. Again, as I said, there aren't many cases that were published this week. Sometimes there are lots of them, sometimes there are not. Now, one of the headlines, of course, in this week was that an estate of a former federal magistrate judge for the District of New Jersey has been hit with a lawsuit seeking reimbursement of almost $180,000 that he allegedly took from a mentally incompetent woman while serving as her guardian. Now, of course, these are allegations. There'd have to be proof. And however, anyone who's acting as a guardian has responsibility, and there's serious responsibilities. So that, you know, whether that goes forward or not, anyone who is asked to be a trustee or a guardian needs to take the situation seriously if they plan on doing it. There's always the issues about Facebook and Twitter and what kind of authority there is to investigate these things. And in New Jersey, we have a New Jersey Office of Attorney Ethics, and that agency is the office that does investigations. We also have local boards in each of the vicinages that look at ethics and do some of the investigations in the prosecution and ethics cases that are filed against lawyers. But in this case, the state Supreme Court ruled on April 19th that the Office of Attorney Ethics has the authority to investigate ethics grievances against lawyers, even after the local district ethics committees have decided to dismiss them. So this is very important. What this means is that there could be a grievance filed against an attorney here in Hunterdon County, and after the investigation, it's decided here that it will be dismissed. That doesn't bar our central ethics to investigate the same grievances and take action. Now, there's going to be a lot of controversy about that, and one of the reasons that the local ethics committees were established and still do that type of work is that it was felt that they would do a better job looking at ethical violations in the community. And, of course, there's been, in recent years, the New Jersey Office of Attorney Ethics has expanded, has taken over many, many more of these investigations. And, there's a lot of controversy about that because it's one more bureaucracy. And not that attorneys who are unethical shouldn't be prosecuted. But, I think many of us who've served on the local ethics committees, felt that we did a yeoman's job. I mean, this is really a difficult process to have to investigate a fellow attorney, have to do a good job, and I think most of us bent over backwards to not only do the investigation, but when necessary, do the prosecution. And so there's a question about whether or not that should be done locally or whether, this big office of attorney ethics should just take over. They've taken over a lot. The appeals court in New Jersey has ruled that plaintiffs suing contractors working for public entities do not have to comply with the 90-day notice requirement in the state's Tort Claims Act. Anybody interested in that should really look at that much more carefully. Now, one of the concerns, if in fact you are a trustee or you know anyone who's a trustee or an executor and you're managing money, there was an error in this case were found to mismanage a family trust by speculating on volatile stocks and failing to repay borrowed money. That one is a real no-no. But in this case, this trustee is on the hook for almost $138,000 in attorney's fees, as was directed under a default clause in the will. And this is the appellate division decision that the trustee is required to pay the attorney's fees on the other side. Again, over since we also have the sports guys, but this is always anything dealing with sports and the law. I think you'd find John Manfreda and Bill Wolfson and I are always interested in these cases. In this case, over the objections from dozens of retired National Football League players, a federal appeals court has upheld the league's $1 billion concession litigation settlement that would compensate more than 20,000 former players. So that's that is the players that didn't think it was enough, they lose. And so that 20,000 players, you know, $1 billion, it, I guess it depends on, you know, what your view is, but whether or not that's enough or not, I'm not sure we'll ever know. But it's $1 billion, and that was the settlement, and that was approved. And the players who wanted to object to that did not win on that one. Now, you know, if you want to get public records, what is, you know, how do you do that? How do you go about it? At least there's a case that you should read. And there was a law division order requiring Galloway Township and its clerk to provide plaintiff with two email logs that he had requested under the Open Public Records Act, which is OPRA, and the statute on that is NJSA 47:1A-1-13, and that is the act that you really need to read to make sure that you are properly requesting what you want to request and that they can give it to you. And then this was the reason for this is that because OPRA does not require public agencies to create records that do not already exist, they concluded that the plaintiff was not entitled to the logs requested in the case. So that is, there's always a question of what someone has to go ahead and provide or create. And this is constantly done in litigation and records. And when someone, for example, asks a client to provide a list of something, whatever it is, if they don't have that list, they don't have to produce it. And this is similar. They're saying here that, you know, they don't, the agencies don't have to create records. I have not read the entire case, but that is basically, that's what they're saying. They don't have to correct records. Excuse me, create records, not correct them. Create records. And if they'd had these records, then they'd have to produce them. Well, we'll be back in just a couple minutes. I want to tell you who's sponsoring the program today.
Let Stowaway Self-Storage be your local moving and storage solution. With three great locations in Hunterdon County, Stowaway is conveniently located in Flemington, White House, and Lebanon. Stowaway Self-Storage offers sizes from 5x5 to 50x50, discounted packing supplies, and U-Haul rentals on site. Affordable monthly rentals for your personal and business use, let Stowaway help you park your car in the garage again or store those old records that you need to keep. Visit us at stowawayselfstorage.com and mention this ad to receive 50% off your first month's rent.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunterdon Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunterdon Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand. or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingtonChamberRadio.com app today.
This is Tony Clark, paraplanner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Okay, we're back. I'm Pat Smith, the program It's the Law. I'd like to talk to you about a few unpublished cases. Now, this means that although these cases may be of great interest to litigants, they are not published, so they cannot be used by attorneys as precedent. But they're still very important, and it certainly allows us to take a look at how an appellate court is thinking about cases, and there are lots of reasons why they're not published. In fact, I believe there should be more cases published, and I've expressed that before in this forum and in other forums. But in any event, there was a pension, public employees retirement system case that is the first case I'd like to talk about. And in that case, the plaintiff appealed from the final decision of the Board of Trustees of the public employees retirement system. What they did is they denied his application for accidental disability retirement benefits, but granted him ordinary disability benefits. Now, in reaching its determination, the board adopted the initial decision of the administrative law judge, and these cases are heard by administrative law judges. And in that case, the administrative law judge found that the applicant failed to establish that his permanent disability was the direct result of his work-related injuries. So that's an important fact. The ALJ, the administrative law judge, also determined that the appellant's, meaning the person who's asking for the benefits, his application concerning a 2003 injury was untimely, obviously meaning late. Now, the appellate division, and this is where these cases are heard, they go to an appellate case, appellate judge, just like other cases from trial courts do. But the appellate court said that because the administrative law judge did not identify the standard she applied for determining whether the appellant's disability was a direct result of the traumatic events he incurred, or whether he had filed a timely application for benefits, and as a result of that, because of that failure to identify the standards, or whether or not he had filed a timely application, the appellate court reversed the board's decision denying the appellant's application for accidental disability retirement fund benefits. And then they remanded this so that the board could reconsider appellant's application under appropriate standards. So basically, they said the board should not have adopted the administrative judge's findings in that particular case, and they had to go back and at least use the appropriate standard. Doesn't mean that the appellate division said they had to grant the benefits, just that they had to look at the appropriate standard. And that often happens with the appellate division. There's also a residential and commercial real estate case that would be a perhaps some interest, or at least people should be aware of things like this. And the case is Ronaldo versus DeLuca. And again, it was an appellate division case. And in that case, the plaintiff deeded property adjacent to her property to her brother. Now, the land was subject to a 19-foot-wide easement for so people could go in and out. They call it ingress and egress, but that's what it means. It's that you can get in and out of your property. So the property was later sold to the defendant, in this case, DeLuca. And he was aware of the easement when he purchased the property. Now, he subsequently built a retaining wall, which was a stone wall and a patio, that entered into the easement and planted three plants near the retaining wall. And as a result, plaintiff filed her complaint alleging defendant violated the easement agreement and intentionally interfered with her use and enjoyment of the property and committed trespass by dumping various unwanted materials on her property. In this case, the judge granted the defendant's motion for summary judgment and denied the plaintiff's cross motion. So the appellate court affirmed, and it found that the plaintiff did not present any objective evidence that the defendant unreasonably interfered with her use of the easement. And they did this and said this because she did not provide an expert report, she did not provide a survey or other data that showed the width of the easement at the points at which the defendant's walls, patio, and trees were encroaching on the common driveway. And instead, she relied on her son's subjective opinion that the defendant's encroachments upon the easement caused a van to get stuck. And this is apparently his van, and it slid off the driveway, and then his brother had to have and also had a tire blown on a large truck. So, again, all of this was supported by inconclusive photographs that did not illuminate his contentions. So the court found similarly there was no evidence as to the size of the plants and the extent which they allegedly interfered with the use of the easement. So basically what this says is if you're going to court on things, you have to make sure that you really have good proofs. And this was a matter of proof. The appellate division said that she had not proved it. And, of course, in that case, since having an easement is important, it would have behooved her to have an expert coming in to say that, in fact, what the defendant did interfered with the use that they had the right. So that the appellate court didn't say she didn't have a right, or her brother, they both had a right to use the easement. The question was, did the defendant at all interfere with their use of the easement? And the court said no. So that's why that one went back. And there's a domestic violence case that I think is important to talk about only because these are very, very tough cases. I just got a call the other day from someone and gave him some advice because his wife had received a temporary restraining order. And frankly, the circumstances, as he explained them, were not egregious. But it's very easy to get a temporary restraining order in New Jersey if, in fact, there are allegations under the statute. Now, it's not always as easy to get a final restraining order. But in any event, this was a restraining order that was entered years ago. So the defendant in this case, who was used the initials, and the court used the initials J.A., appealed from an order denying his motion to vacate a final restraining order entered pursuant to the statute. And the statute is the Prevention of Domestic Violence Act. And what happened is the court had entered a final restraining order against him I'm assuming it's a him because I didn't read the case or I couldn't tell from the portion of the case that I read So I'm making an assumption. But in any event, that FRO was entered on March 24th, 2004, and it prohibited him, I guess it was a him, from having any contact with the plaintiff BR, the victim. The plaintiff in these cases is called the victim, or her family household members. It also prevented him from going to her residence or place of employment and from possessing any firearms. So what happened is over 10 years later, the defendant filed an application. And it was an application with the court requesting the court to vacate the final restraining order. He claimed that he had completed probation and had no contact or communication with the victim for almost 10 years. Now, on September of 2014, both parties appeared before the first judge to hear the motion. And, however, at that point, it was adjourned until October. So we had September 2014, then it was adjourned for almost a month to October. And the first judge entered an amended final restraining order excusing the victim from attending the scheduled hearing and acknowledged her request to continue the restraints in place. So in other words, in this case, the victim, even 10 years later, wanted the restraints to continue. Now, other than that, the FRO remained unchanged. At that point, the defendant retained an attorney who submitted a certification claiming that the defendant did not have contact with the victim for 10 years, did not possess any weapons, and successfully completed his probation for a criminal contempt conviction related to the violation of the restraining order. So what had happened here is even after the final restraining order, this defendant had some contact that was sufficient enough to be charged with contempt and convicted of contempt. He may have pleaded guilty, but convicted or pleaded guilty of contempt and be given probation. Now, that had occurred, however, in no later than 2005. So again, both the incident and the violation were many years ago. Now, this certification also said that J.A. worked as a gasoline tanker driver, was married, and had four children. Now, at the hearing in October only, the defendant and his counsel were present. The matter was before a new judge. And however, for some reason they thought this was important, the same court clerk was present at both proceedings. The judge then did not require the clerk to be put under oath, but allowed her to speak. So this is really fatal. In other words, anyone speaking in the courtroom other than the attorneys are supposed to be put under oath. And the defendant's attorney objected to the court's reliance on the court clerk's unsworn testimony. And, of course, that is very significant because, you know, everyone testifying has to be sworn in. It's amazing how many people lie despite being sworn in, but they have to be sworn in. So, and additionally, the lawyer objected to the court making a decision without the opportunity to cross-examine BR. That was pretty clever. So his attorney was trying to make every objection possible, and the only thing he could have cross-examined BR about was why after 10 years she felt that the restraining order should continue. He would not have been able to cross-examine her on anything that took place 10 years earlier, because after that hearing, the trial judge found the defendant guilty. So anyway, at the urging of the clerk, the court listened to a recording of the September appearance. And then the judge denied the motion without prejudice. And, of course, what the appellate division said is, given that the trial judge was unable to observe BR's demeanor in September, and nothing in the record suggested the parties had any contact since 2005, the appellate division concluded, and obviously they rule, they will overrule a trial court. And so that what their rule was is that whether or not the victim had any objectively reasonable fear of the defendant, that would be the standard, or just was acting in bad faith, was a material fact. And therefore, in this case, the defendant had demonstrated a prima facie case for good cause and changed circumstances to warrant a plenary hearing. And the panel vacated the order denying his motion and remanded for a plenary hearing. Now, very often, that's exactly what the appellate division does. They send it back and tell the trial judge that they should have a plenary hearing. Good in some ways, but on the other hand, it can take an inordinate amount of time for a plenary hearing to be scheduled. And that is because the judges are so overworked. So there's another case, and just you can't just go in and say you want to reduce alimony or child support. In this one, there was the court ordered denying a motion to reduce child support, and the reason for that was he voluntarily left his job and enrolled in an online college. And so in that case, the judge found that his underemployment was not only voluntary, but was also temporary. So that's what we have to look at, whether it was voluntary and whether it was temporary. And on appeal, he argued that the court did not provide sufficient findings of fact and conclusions of law and erred in failing to acknowledge that his efforts to promote the best interest of the child, that he was doing that by enrolling full-time in college, and that was a change of circumstances warranting reduction. And further, by not ordering a plenary hearing, that was a mistake. Now, in this case, the appellate panel affirmed and said that the plaintiff failed to offer sufficient proof as to why he should be relieved of the obligation of his pre-existing duty to provide child support when making career choices. Further, the party certifications filed with the family part did not create a genuine, material, and legitimate factual dispute, and that's why a plenary hearing was not required according to the appellate division. And so that's always an issue, whether there should be a plenary hearing or not. And in this case, the appellate division said, nope, you don't need to, and you have to continue paying your child support. Okay, we'll be back after a few more, little more information from our sponsors. And since I can't find it, maybe we won't find the list. But I did find the list. And so we'll be back, talk about a few more cases and some of the other things that are coming up as far as legal issues in our community.
Home Instead Senior Care. It's our passionate dedication to creating personal relationships between our clients and our caregivers. Visit our website at www.homeinstead.com/325. You've got a friend.
Boy, not sure what happened there. We'll have to check that one. That's home care.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Hunterton Medical Center was started by families for families. Inside our circle of care, we offer coordinated care for your entire family, led by our outstanding family medicine physicians and specialists. Hunterton Healthcare, your full circle of care. If you need a physician, call Hunterton Medical Center's Physician Referral Service at 1-800-511-4HMC or visit us on the web at www.huntertonhealthcare.org.
Hi, this is Ruth Ann Disatel, celebrant officiant with Celebration of a Lifetime. When people ask me why I joined the Chamber, it's because I want to get to know you and what you're all about. And I want you to get to know me and what I'm all about. And together, I'd like to celebrate what we can do for Hunterton County.
Hunterton Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Hi, I'm back. It's The Law is the Program. I'm Pat Smits, an attorney here in Hunterdon County. And although you know I often spout my ideas, they are not necessarily the ideas of the chamber. And however, I just try to bring you up to date on some of the things that happen to be happening in legal news. And right now I'd like to talk a little bit about a tax situation. I've been getting calls from people, even though I don't handle tax matters, but it's really important that business owners know the difference as to whether someone should be hired as an independent contractor or as an employee. And it's a very significant difference and can create real problems if you don't do it correctly. What I'd like to do is also give credit to a lot of this information to Andy Ross. He's a CPA at Bedard, Kerwicki and Company. Andy can be called at 908-782-7900, extension 113. So if you have any questions about this, call Andy, call your own accountant, call an attorney who deals with this, because frankly, it can create serious problems for employers if you hire someone as an independent contractor when, in fact, they legitimately should have been hired as an employee. So most businesses, when we require some additional staffing, we think about hiring either an employee or an independent contractor. Now, of course, the difference is that for an employee, the employer is required to withhold federal and state income taxes, Social Security, and Medicare taxes. And, of course, we must match those taxes and with the what is withheld from the employee. And we also have to withhold state unemployment and disability taxes. Well, I am actually in a case right now where the wife worked as a nanny, and the people paid her as an independent contractor. Now, the difference there, whether it's a difference or not, they had her sign a contract that not only she was an independent contractor, but they were paying her extra money because she would have to pay the Social Security taxes. As an independent contractor, that's what's necessary. Now, for an employer hiring an independent contractor, all that is necessary is for the business to report the amount paid during the year to the IRS. So you have to file a form saying how much you paid independent contractors. And as a result, the business, many businesses want to classify as many of their workers as they can as independent contractors rather than hiring them as employees. Now, of course, from the person's standpoint, hired as an independent contractor means that the person must pay both the employee and the employer's share of Social Security from the money they receive. But that's not truly the issue today. The issue is what determines whether someone's an employee or an independent contractor. Because if the IRS determines that an employee has misclassified workers as independent contractors, the IRS can reclassify the workers as employees and assess the applicable payroll taxes, which will also generate assessments of penalties and interest for late filing and payment of employment taxes. So, bad thing to happen to an employer. Now, you know, sometimes businesses might misclassify workers as independent contractors, especially if they work part-time or only are working for a short duration. That's not the issue. However, the IRS's position is that if the employer has the right to direct and control how the worker performs the task and has the right to control the business aspects of the worker's job, then that person is an employee, not an independent contractor. So also, if the worker is paid on a regular periodic basis rather than when the job is finished, the worker is probably an employee. Now, the permanency of the working relationship is also very important and has to be looked at. So if the business intends to employ the worker for an indefinite period, then they're most likely employees, not independent contractors. So, what else can we learn? I remember recently there was something in the news regarding Uber drivers, because California determined that Uber drivers were employees rather than independent contractors. Now, because Uber had provided smartphones to their drivers and monitored their approval ratings by customers and deactivated their accounts if they were performing unsatisfactorily, all three states, New York, Texas, and Georgia, had agreed with Uber's position, and that the drivers were states that said they should be employees, for example, California, and then there were other states that agreed with Uber's position that the drivers were independent contractors. So obviously this would be something in any issue if you're trying to find out, about a potential employee. It would be good to find out, you know, how has he or she been classified in the past. Now, the one thing that Andy would tell you, or anyone else would tell you, that there's no black and white test. I'm not being political correct, but there's no actual test as to whether a particular worker is an employee or an independent contractor. However, if you have a case of workers who could legitimately be classified as either independent contractors or employees, then you can apply to the IRS for a private letter ruling. Well, I don't think, from what I know, nobody's in that situation here. So I think you have to look very carefully exactly at exactly the situation what I do know is you don't want to be in some kind of an IRS catch-up or IRS sting, or just receive that letter from the IRS that they're seeking back taxes and penalties because you haven't done something. So that is, again, it's very important. And frankly, if you're going into a job, it's very important from your standpoint. In other words, are you an employee? Well, if you're an employee, then your employer has to pay, half of your Social Security tax. And I think there are too many